Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast.
Stephen, you have returned from Birmingham. What was Tory Party conference like?
To be honest, the really unnerving, weird thing, right, is that you went from one conference where its party grassroots feel they've been given their party back to another place where the grassroots feel they've been given their party back, except for reasons which will, you know, don't really need to be explained. I found the second one a lot less congenial, right? And also the second lot are in government, right? And it's slightly strange because, I mean, you have the kind of Tories who are like, well, I thought then Blair and Brown had just had you, like, stuffed and mounted somewhere. I thought Cameron had then, like, thrown these people out. Liam Fox is a significant force in Conservative politics again. David Davis is a significant power player.
But don't you think that is the story of both conferences, is a kind of reset of both of the parties to their, not maybe necessarily their default setting, but certainly a much more familiar groove? I mean, so much of Jeremy Corbyn's rhetoric is about, you know, tearing down Tony Blair and what he stood for and what Blairism stood for. And then now you've basically got Theresa May doing the same thing to kind of Cameroon liberalism.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, I think, one, it's a time of political polarisation. Two, yeah, there's something very interesting. And then although Ed Cameron and Nick Clegg did not have a similar politics as some people would like to pretend, they did all have the kind of look of a fungible white bloke of varying degrees of attractiveness from, you know,
Nick Clegg
Ed
got the,
to Clegg.
Okay, good. We were both in the same team of about which way that went.
But now, of course, you have May, Corbyn, and Tim Farron, right? So, like, it's quite a...
You get a decent spread, I think, there. Something for everybody. Here's my thing. So let's talk about the speech. I mean, this is kind of, we're recording this directly after Theresa May did her speech. I thought it was...
We have to go straight to have a lot of anger about a lot of other speeches.
Okay, go on. Quick, run me through your three worst other speeches, or three most memorable other speeches from Tory Party conference.
Well, I think the first most memorable one is Theresa May's first one, in which she confirmed what we kind of all knew, but we're all kind of whispering to ourselves that Philip Hammond would somehow save the day, which is that control over our borders is going to be
more important than staying in the single market.
Yeah.
More important than almost anything else in politics.
Well, yeah, basically, for the first time in the history of Britain, and I think actually arguably in an advanced democracy, immigration policy is going to decide trade policy. I can't think of a single other place where you could say that was the case. That is a fairly big and wrenching change. It is also, in my view, going to be a catastrophic one for the economy, the country, the condition of minorities of various kinds. Then I think Amber Rudd, particularly because I like Amber Rudd. Amber Rudd is not crazy. And yet Amber Rudd was saying really crazy and awful things.
Well, here's the thing I think is really fascinating about that conference. It felt so... unpluralist. What's the opposite of pluralist? It just felt like anybody, apart from Anna Soubry, who has entered the sort of Ken
and
Clark,
Nicky Morgan.
Yeah, both of whom have entered the kind of Ken Clark YOLO phase of their careers. It just felt that if you were Remainy or you were, you know, in any way sort of single market advocate. Actually, Ruth Davidson stood up for the single market, and she also said grammar schools weren't the right policy for Scotland. So maybe I can include her in the roll call of honour on that one. But it just felt like everyone else just was keeping their mouth shut, right? This was the new... It had some of the same triumphalism that I found quite unpleasant at Labour conference. A sort of kind of slightly gloating sense among the victors that, you know, that they had not only won, but they had crushed their opposition. So that's two. And then your third highlight, lowlight?
My third highlight. I mean, there must have been something I actually enjoyed, right?
Did you watch Andrea Leadsom's speech where she said, "Naan bread," and then, like, looked round for applause?
Yeah, so I enjoyed the Andrea Leadsom speech because, and this doesn't reflect at all well on me, after Brexit, a lot of the lobby decided that unpredictable things would happen and therefore Andrea Leadsom would win. There was no evidence for this, no evidence in the polls, no evidence in terms... Yeah, there was just it was just hard, really hard to support the idea that Andrea Leadsom was going to win. And then a Conservative Party conference, she could barely fill the hall, and her kind of speech was a bit of a...
Meanwhile, Theresa May was like... catnip.
And her biggest cheer was mentioning Theresa May.
And I mean, talk about tickling people's tummies. Theresa May's speech, her Wednesday speech, went down like, you know... I mean, she kept... Actually, it was a problem. It was something that you've identified in previous Corbyn speech. She kept stepping on the applause lines because she wasn't kind of expecting the rapturousness of the response.
Yeah, no, she was...
Okay, yeah, here's my problem, right? This is what I think Theresa May has done with her speech today, and I think that this is a quite a common, judging from my Twitter time and left-wing view. I don't think it's not a speech that I liked at all, but it's a speech that I can see is very effective, popular. I think maybe it's an election winner, but it's not an election that I'm looking forward to covering, that's for sure. It was, and I don't, this is going to provoke howls of outrage, but the classical definition of national socialism, I'm talking about it without the Third Reich books, is this sort of assertion that your country is the best, there's something kind of qualities that are unique to it, plus also the state should therefore guard and defend those people and be very interventionist. I thought what was really interesting about May's speech is that it married this kind of muscular state and, you know, highly interventionist policy with a very hard line on, you know, who us is, who the people are, who's welcome here.
Which is kind of, works for everyone with a very heavy asterisk at the end of everyone.
That's, yeah. And there was a very much as kind of them and us feeling about a lot of it. And migration being the most obvious sign of that. But I pause because, you know, moments of levity are hard to find here. But all the people who voted for Brexit or campaign for Brexit on the basis it would usher in this sort of great open neoliberal trading nation that was open to the world have now had their chips thoroughly pissed on, even than kind of the classical left, I would say.
I mean, so that is really one of the few crumbs of comfort in this dark time, right, is laughing at two groups of people. One, people who think that the Brexit vote wasn't about immigration. I mean, if it wasn't, why did you have all those posters about how if
breaking
we stayed
point.
In, the breaking point. But, you know, also in the official campaign with its, you know, 11 billion Turks will rock up if we stay in there. What did they think that was about? Did they think it was people were worried and, I don't know, like, there would be too much tzatziki in our streets? No, that was because people were demonising immigrants. You know, and then the other group of people who we have not laughed at enough. Lexiters. If you wanted a left-wing exit for the EU, I mean, I would just like to congratulate you on how well your plan is going. I mean, step one is Theresa May is Prime Minister. Step two is she's trying to bring back grammar schools. Step three is this...
Underpants gnomes.
Is kicking out, you know, doctors. I mean, guys, you
lists
better have a
foreign
great step
workers.
Four because the steps so far are not filling me with confidence is all I am saying. But
do you know what I mean? I just feel that's a message, actually. It's when you say a country that works for everybody, I think actually it's a country that, you know, it's that message was aimed at 40 to 45% of people. It was aimed at soft UKIP-y switchers. It was aimed at socially conservative Labour voters in the north of England. I think it's a message with a big electoral constituency that finds that appealing, right? Mm. The other thing I think will be a real test of our profession in the next couple of months is whether or not people report on the words or the actions. And already I can see them diverging quite strongly. So you're getting all this sort of stuff about, oh, it's Milibandite and all this kind of stuff. Well, the policies are not...
If anyone wants to bet, Helen, which one our industry will do... I feel there is some easy money to be made here.
But I just really feel like I'm getting ready for 6 months of being told that, you know, Theresa May is making a bold pitch for the centre ground while she's kind of also, you know, all this stuff that's happening with schools asking people for their, you know, children for their birth certificates or, you know, that kind of stuff about landlords being kind of drafted in as part of the immigration system to check up on people's passports, charities being asked to check that the people who are using their services are British citizens. I just think you can either, you know, those two things do not mesh together. And I suspect that we're about to hear an awful lot of hot air about kind of social justice that will not necessarily be backed up by actions.
I also think, you know, one of the important things, and you cannot build a country that works for everyone if we are not in the single market, right? I think that there is an awful lot of delusional behaviour, not just among people who voted for Brexit, but people who kind of, You know, Brexit was like a heart attack, right? You might survive it. To be honest, it's still an open question whether or not the United Kingdom will survive Brexit. But you might survive it, but you're not the same afterwards.
And you really need to stop eating butter.
And you really need to stop eating
butter. And maybe go for a run.
Yeah, the thing is, like, if Britain leaves the single market, as it looks like, we are not going to have a country which works for everyone. We're going to have a country in which most people are poorer than they are now, and not just for a short while, but for the foreseeable future. Then this idea, kind of, than Downing Street wants to have, where you kind of have one bucket of Brexit, which the government does, and then a bucket of social reform. No. There's just the bucket of Brexit. It spills over everything else. It's full of really nasty stuff that no one wants, right? Brexit is a disaster, and that was the thing I found maddening, is this kind of exercise in particularly people like Philip Hammond and Amber Rudd, who actually did fight to the last ditch to stop this looming disaster, kind of standing up and kind of going, but now I've realised it's all going to be fine. It's not going to be fine.
That's the thing I think has been most interesting, actually. So as I say, the reactions on the left to that speech were pretty united. I think most people found it worrying, but they thought it was very effective. The reactions on the right were kind of more interesting. I mean, obviously, you saw the front pages of the papers today. I mean, the Mail loved it, could not have loved it more. Like, if tomorrow's Daily Mail is not full of just happy, frolicking kittens, then you will know that nothing in the world makes them happy, because it was so expertly tailored towards them. But, you know, actually, if you are a Daniel Hannan or a free trader or a George Osborne or anyone from that kind of strain of the right, this was a great big FU to those people too. I saw Alex Wickham, who I think is a person I've ever previously agreed with about anything, saying that he found it was an unpleasant kind of pastiche of everything that Remainers paint Brexiters as being. So I think that's more of an open question. I think I'm pretty sure I know how the left feels about Mayism as a pitch. I'm more interested to know how the right generally feels about it. I mean, obviously, as you say, the grassroots lapped it up. Like, the people in the hall loved it.
I think the other interesting thing about all of this, right, is that the way she is channeling Miliband is it's actually a 35% strategy, right? So Ed's plan was you held on to the 28% Gordon got, and you added to that the votes of the flatlining Lib Dems, and bam, you're in office. And basically, Theresa May's electoral strategy is it's not a pitch for the common round. It's a pitch for not just UKIP voters, but Labour voters who are flirting with UKIP, Labour voters in Wales who vote Labour in the constituencies, UKIP on the list, Tory voters who, were UKIP in the 2014 Euros, or are UKIP in parliamentary election. It's basically, a 44%.
I think it's a higher percentage than Miliband, which is why it might succeed when Miliband doesn't fail.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, obviously, Ed fell short by 4 points. Falling short of 4 points of 44% is still quite terrifyingly good for the Conservative Party in terms of the parliamentary arithmetic. But the problem Ed had is it turned out that actually that base of support, it turned out, was not a base. Mm. Actually, there were people who liked Gordon Brown who he could not guarantee the support of. And I think one of the fault lines, not to foreshadow our next sentiment, but one of the fault lines is I think she may discover that the appeal of Cameron is underrated.
Well, I think that's an interesting thing, because so the line that got the most applause in the hall was the kind of, and the Labour are the new nasty party, which if you're a Tory activist is exactly what you want to hear, right? But I was thinking this morning, the great success of UKIP was essentially to launder anti-immigration sentiment through the prism of Europe. Because actually, I don't think most people in Britain want to feel that they're voting to be beastly to benefits claimants and immigrants. Actually, they want, they will stop at like tough but fair. And I worry that although it didn't seem like it as in every individual speech, actually when you put them all together, it began to look a little bit, I imagine them kind of looking and thinking, actually, have we gone slightly too far here? This is just maybe a bit too much. There were lots of references to our homegrown Brits and our own people and those kind of things, which you can't pick them out one by one. And I think if I say this on Twitter, I'll get all kinds of right wingers howling at me for being oversensitive. But the kind of accretion of them began to make you feel like, oh, hang on a minute, okay, this is where we're going on this, is it?
Yeah, and I think. Yeah, I think actually, and just as with, in the Ed era, I think there was a failure to appreciate what the kind of tonnage of the things you were saying added together that made people feel, you know, that people agreed with the mansion tax, they agreed with 50p, they agreed with the energy price fees, but it kind of came together and they were like, oh, I think you're going to tax me next. I think there is definitely a risk to them than that will happen.
But that's what it felt like. It felt like she gets so much more credit for saying, when they say things like, you know, the Tories have raised spending on the NHS, you know, because that's playing against the kind of type. And you can do it with a kind of wink that says, oh, don't worry, we're still very fiscally responsible, but we're going to be nice about it. Whereas Labour's problem always is people think that they're going to be nice. They just think they're going to be kind of spendthrift. But there were, so it's that thing of you're already accentuating something which is an existing perception in your mind, which is why I think, you know, the poshness thing was so problematic for David Cameron, because it was building on foundations that had already been laid, something that kind of already appealed to people. When you're fighting against a narrative, it's harder for that perception to stick.
Yeah.
Do you think that it was the best Tory leadership? I mean, in terms of, do you think it will cut through? Do you think the clip of it on the 10 o'clock news or on Magic FM or whatever, you know, is gonna reach people?
I don't think it will, because one of the things about it is that what was its message, right? So the message that was briefed and the message that is duly being reported by a lot of the printers is, oh, I'm reaching out to the centre ground. But what was the kind of one-liner that was new or about the centre ground?
I was surprised at how that there wasn't any policy in it. And they said that this was a very deliberate thing, that they just actually, they wanted this to be an articulation of her vision. But the trouble is that policies are the demonstrable, you know, they're your principles in practice, right? And then, so you can kind of say, you know, I mean, like the way that George Osborne used tax avoidance every time he wanted to say, look, I'm not too soft on the rich, and that's why we're going after X, Y, you know, and that's why I'm going after Google or whoever. There was one very coded kind of attack on Facebook for not cooperating on terrorism, another one on Philip Green for the pension fund at BHS. But there was no naming names and sort of taking people down. So I think that will make it quite hard to up some. I mean, maybe that was their plan. They just wanted the headline just to be Theresa May makes pitch for centre ground. And I'm sure they will get some of those headlines. But yeah, there's not a lot of depth to it. Anyway, we'll return to this in a longer version of You Ask Us in a minute.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And together we host the New Statesman's pop culture podcast, Seriously. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can get this episode and everything else we've done on newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
Now it's time for a section we call You Ask Us, in which you ask us questions. To be honest, a lot of them could really be described as howls of despair.
Yeah, they're more like sort of how, why, where can we go? I can answer a couple of ones very quickly. Where is Jeremy Corbyn? We had thought that he was up by Hadrian's Wall, where he bought his wife some upcycled knitwear, but he has just released a statement saying that the speech was fanning the flames of xenophobia. So I think that there was a feeling among a kind of Labour activists that they wanted a strong condemnation of some of the rhetoric on migration, and they've got that. So that's that one. I've answered that very quickly. Here's one that I think is really interesting. What are the weaknesses in May's vision? If you're the Labour leader and you're trying to attack it, where do you go on it?
I mean, so I think there are a couple of fairly big vulnerability points. The first, and of course the slight problem with this, is the Labour leadership also doesn't want to stay in the single market. But, you know, as I said earlier on, if you want to leave the single market, you can't build an economy that works for everyone, right? Those two aims are absolutely incompatible, right? And I honestly don't know what the political consequences will be of the recession that I think will be triggered either when we leave or when it becomes apparent to enough of business in the markets and we, in fact, are going to leave the single market.
That's typical Ramona thinking, Stephen.
Yeah, what
I think you'll find that we're going to become a great trading nation. My problem with all of that is that I think still it'd be really interesting to see how it shakes out. But I just think anyone trying to call it either way is, at the moment, is risks absurd, either early pessimism or triumphalism, right? I just think it's all so hard to read. Anyway, that doesn't answer the question of how do you attack the Theresa May speech.
So I think one, this is, but also, actually, in lots of ways, I mean, I don't really buy this idea and she's put tanks on Labour's lawn, but let's roll with it for a second. The brilliant thing about someone putting tanks on your lawn is it's a home fixture, right? And unless you're, you know, I don't know, like Aston Villa, you mostly win your games at home, right? That's like, the point of a, in an election campaign, what you basically want is you want to draw the issues which are you're not comfortable with, or minimise them so they aren't an issue.
Yeah, if you're Labour, you want people to argue about the NHS and who's better for the NHS, because people hear the NHS is a very important issue, and then the kind of baseline is that people assume that Labour is better on the NHS.
If someone, it's brilliant news for the Labour Party to have a Conservative Prime Minister who says the really important thing is helping everyone get on, and their solution to that is a schooling system, which...
Well, one in five children from a low-income family will get into a grammar, statistically.
Yeah, and also which has just been discredited by every serious thinker to look at it. I mean, as far as the case for grammar schools, we are dangerously close to that you can have your own opinions, but you can't have your own facts.
Well, I think that's one that's definitely, as we saw from last week's Labour conference, is a productive space for Labour to attack. I mean, they've got that good line, segregation, segregation, segregation. And it's something that they're fighting kind of a slightly, quite an intelligent campaign about why it's not, rather than doing it as... I think too often Michael Gove was able to paint it as the kind of vested interest of the teaching profession against parents, and Labour haven't kind of walked into that trap on the way they framed their argument on grammar schools. They framed it about parents not getting a choice, like less choice in the school system. Yeah. So that's quite effective. Okay, let's move on to the next one. If Jeremy Corbyn became a centrist overnight, is there any space for him left after May's speech? Says somebody. I think we probably kind of covered that in our belief that it wasn't a particularly centrist speech.
But yeah, I mean, I also think, like, values are really important in politics, and they're an important part of how you get your platform, which is how you... But actually, for people who really care about, who decide elections, it's competence, right? Because if you say... People kind of know that if they have a choice between competence and fairness, right, they'll choose competence because they know you can't have fairness if you're not competent, right? You can't successfully make things fair.
But
even if it was this miraculous centrist speech, which I don't accept, but let's roll with the idea it is. Well, then the fight would just be about, but we're better at this. It becomes a question of valence rather than of values.
My issue is, and I think Duncan Weldon, who used to be the economics editor at Newsnight, has made this point today. I wonder if we're not moving into a sphere where identity trumps economics. I mean, you can see it with the support for Scottish independence. Every respected economist thinks that Scottish independence would make Scotland a poorer country. But there are people clearly for whom either they don't believe that, or they don't mind because they want this. They want an independent Scotland so much that they're willing to take that hit. And I think it's one of those things also that's a kind of cruel double-edged standard for Labour. Labour have to be really, really competent. But actually, you're seeing a Conservative Party that's just picked a massive fight with business. But we'll probably kind of get away with that. We'll certainly get a much easier ride. I saw Robert Peston tweeting about Philip Hammond doesn't have, hasn't come up with kind of new borrowing rules, right, after having ditched the surplus target. And that's kind of been kind of hand-waved away, because we all know that the Conservatives are fine and can be trusted on the economy.
Yeah, but equally, I don't think we are in an era where identity is going to trump economics. So to take the Scottish example, mostly if you voted yes, you weren't convinced that you would be worse off. There was a small core of people who were saying, I'm willing to be worse off in the short term, or I'm willing to be worse off forever to have my freedom. And there are people like that in the Brexit debate. Mm. But actually, the big variable was not a dislike of immigration. Depressingly, most British voters, including close to half of people who voted Remain, would prefer immigration to go down. The big variable was if you voted Remain and disliked immigration, you were convinced that it couldn't be done in a way which wouldn't leave you being poorer. But I think the difficulty is that people will continue to believe they're not going to get poorer until they actually
demonstrably feel poorer. Well, that was that great research by Philip Cowley, wasn't it, where he asked that, how much would you be personally be willing to pay to cut immigration? And actually, even £25, people weren't. But then you're right. I just think that, and because the way that it's such a diffuse impact on people. Like, it's not like a penny on income tax where you can just see that the amount you're getting in your pay packet has gone down. The effect of Brexit will be much more kind of ambient than that. It's going to be quite hard to persuade people that that's definitely the cause rather than anything else. Let's move on. I think this one's really interesting. This is from Tom Wilson. Of everything announced or hinted at, what will Theresa May have the most trouble getting Tory MPs to back? Because there were a couple of moments from the speech, amidst the rapturous applause, where there was kind of slightly stony silence. She talked about how great the NHS was, and there was a kind of brief smatter of applause. But I mean, realistically, can you see any of the stuff? I mean, again, it was a very policy light speech, that one, but of the other stuff, I think there will be a problem with this idea of lists of foreign workers, because I've seen quite a few Tories grumbling about that, and Amber Rudd herself seemed to be rowing back from it slightly on the Today programme this morning.
Well, I think even in the awful speech, they suggest it as an awful idea they might do. It won't happen. Yeah, I think partly because the really striking thing about that is the bits of the business lobby which kind of try and couch all of their objections to everything either the government or the opposition does in a kind of, well, we'd prefer it if you didn't shoot us in the head kind of way, had already gone into the full-on, if you shoot us in the head, you better not miss, because we are going to come for you. I think that won't happen, but not because of the Conservative Party. I actually am going to have a slightly counterintuitive one, which is grammar schools. What I thought was interesting is that also didn't get a particularly good response in the hall. It is so unpopular among... Yeah, I know this is, you know, a very Remain, a liberal elite argument, but everyone who knows anything about education policy is against it.
Yeah, I mean, you've got people very much on, you know, the Govians, basically, who are still quite powerful and also quite crafty against it, which I think is potentially a bigger problem. Okay, I've got more questions, but I think we should go to another break.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hi, I'm Stephanie.
And I'm John, and we host Skylines, a City Metric podcast, where every 2 weeks we talk about cities, maps and the human world.
Whether the Olympics are good for cities, what it's like to be a woman in a city, and we've had guests like Lauren Elkin, Caroline Criado-Perez.
And Neil Codlin, keyboard player from Suede, because I'm nearly cool now.
Tune in on iTunes or on Acast.
Check it out.
And we're back for yet more You Ask Us. I've got another one, Stephen, which I think... I think this is someone trolling us, but I think it's a good question anyway. Comparing Corbyn and May's rhetoric and policies, will this push Corbyn sceptics like yourself over to his side?
I mean, the problem, right? The problem with people like that, okay, is ultimately people on the left who think that Corbyn is not going well do not think, oh, isn't Theresa May wonderful, right? They think, oh, when it comes to it, this government, which is eminently beatable for many reasons, right? One, you cannot, you know, what are the pressure points to hurt the government? Staying in the single market. He doesn't want to do that. That's before the fact that people think he's incompetent and won't keep them safe, right? So even in a crisis, I find it hard to see that people will... One of the reasons why the left loses so often is this inability to understand the difference between someone going, this isn't working, and I don't want this to work.
Yeah, I think there's a great deal of projection. I mean, I will find quite often that I will tweet something that's a bit, that somebody in the Corbyn team has said, and people will attack me, and you'll be like, well, no, I know I think this is a bad thing, but I'm not creating that. It is something that you actually yourself disagree with, but you kind of can't reconcile that with your general belief in the project. I think that is a kind of a tough thing. I have one more question. How likely does an early election look now post Conservative conference? Asked Noel Davis.
I think significantly less likely. One, because if you spend any time talking to people around Theresa May, the word which keeps two words they love using, honesty and loyalty, right? Those are really important values to them, which is why most of the people who work at Downing Street are people who have served the Conservative Party for a long time. So when they say there won't be an election, I actually would take it more seriously than a lot of other people. The second thing, and the thing they have done very quietly, partly because very few people really care about Northern Ireland, which is a bit bleak when you think about it, is they have wooed the DUP very effectively, right? That is 8 extra votes. So suddenly that majority looks a little bit more comfortable.
So Arlene Foster was at Tory conference, as I understand it. And Gary Gibbons written a very good blog on this on the Channel 4 News website. And there is some sort of, to me, sounding a very hokey sounding idea about you might have kind of automatic customs tracking so that, you know, even if we aren't part of a customs union, you wouldn't have to have essentially border control points and customs checking on that border with the Republic. I think there does sound to be a lot, but I don't know. I mean, this again, I think Ireland is just such a huge sticking point, if you're in fantasies of leaving the single market and also stopping free movement of people, I just think there's going to become a... I don't know. I just don't know if you're the Conservative Party, how you fashion a way of saying, oh, of course we're fine with Irish people being here, but don't apply the same thing to Polish people or Romanians without kind of getting yourself into very, very tricky wording about what kind of immigrants are good immigrants and what kind of immigrants are bad immigrants, right? Because that's the problem, is fundamentally, oh no, people from Ireland are good immigrants. We like them. But yeah, I think that is a lingering problem, and their assiduous wooing of the DUP is going to help them out enormously there.
I think I'm not sure if this was the same question or slightly different. I think the thing is about the argument about whether or not they need or they ought to have a separate mandate, right? I personally feel very strongly they really ought to have to go and get their own electoral mandate. This is a completely different government. The personnel is very different. The policies are very different. However, every poll, and indeed it feels to me every conversation with a non-political person, backs up what Downing Street thinks, which is that people are tired of elections. They had to vote in a referendum. They had to vote in local elections. They had to vote in a general election last year. They don't want to have to vote again, right? People don't like elections. So the difficulty is I think there a lot of people will say, you really ought to have an election. A lot of people will quite rightly share the Theresa May article she wrote when Gordon Brown became Prime Minister, saying he needed to have an election. But people won't care.
It's one of those things, isn't it? It's about like we had this conversation about Europe and about all the people who are really pro-Europe, but actually do they really, really care enough that this is going to become their fixation in the way that leaving Europe was for UKIPers over the last 10 years? I think we're in a really interesting time in politics. I think if I were... Okay, if you're Theresa May, who's the person you're most scared of? Because my answer to that, I think, at the moment is George Osborne.
No, Boris.
She humiliated him, which I think is a really fascinating thing. So her very first gag in the speech was, you know, I come here with questions to answer. And one of them was, can I keep Boris Johnson on message for the next 4 days? And people love that. David Davis was rolling around laughing. But I'm really not sure that Boris is as good at laughing at himself as that joke would presuppose. So, okay, I will give you Boris Johnson
I think Boris did a couple of things. I mean, I feel enough people say Boris is an underrated operator and he is now just a rated operator, so I won't say that. But he did some very clever things at Conservative Party Conference and indeed since being appointed to the Foreign Secretary, right? He knows that part of his brand and appeal is that whole kind of walrus kind of thing.
Yeah.
But he also knows he has to be slightly more serious now and he has to show he is ready to be Foreign Secretary and potentially Prime Minister. What he did in his speech this time is he kind of did a walrusy speech that became less and less walrusy as it went on.
From walrus to Churchill.
He kind of became more... And, you know, if... And, you know, this is where I'm going to be Ramoning again, but my anticipation is a couple of things will happen. One, we will have probably the hardest version of Brexit available, partly because of the things we want, partly because of the need, particularly in France, for Marine Le Pen not to be able to say, look what a great deal you get when you leave the EU. Obviously, if Marine Le Pen does actually become president, then we'll all have bigger problems. The economy will not be in a good state. We'll go into another recession. People will be feeling a bit miserable. People will want to be cheered up. And then suddenly Boris becomes quite lethal because he's quite attractive to the Tory party. You can see how it's attractive to the country. Also, just as we will cling more to Trident as a kind of virility symbol.
Mm-hmm. I know what you mean. He is our Kim Kardashian. He is our Prince George. You know, he's one of those... He's Brand Britain. Okay. Well, that's our predictions made. Let's hope they've been better than some of our other predictions. And that is all from You Ask Us. But you can always tweet us at Stephen KB or at Helen Lewis, or you can leave Photoshop fan art on Stephen's Facebook page.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by Helen Lewis and me, Stephen Bush, and produced by India Bork. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.